calculations that if the resistance factions or resistance groups out of Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Hamas, if they were to turn all, and then to mention Hezbollah, if they were to all turn against Israel, that Israel risks its own national security? Because, you know, it's doing that by attacking Syria.
Yeah, I mean, look, the problem that the Zionists have is the contradiction between their ideal in their head. They believe that they are supreme, that they are the chosen people, and the reality on the ground, which says that they're not, militarily speaking, right now specifically. So what does this mean? That means that their supremacy is contradicting with the assessment, military assessment that is given to them, which without direct American war against, for instance, the whole region in a next war, because we heard the Axis of Resistance leaders all speak after the last war on Palestine saying that they're ready to join in any next war to help. So we know that this is going to happen if there is another war in Palestine, and it surely will come very soon, looking at the situations on the ground. And so at the same time, we have to also realize that it may be not necessary that, you know, Iran, for instance, enter a next war in Palestine. Maybe the Palestinians will be by that point with just a few external helping hands, be able to liberate Palestine without the need for a regional war. And in terms of where we started this conversation, we mentioned the nukes of Israel. Those nukes are useless, honestly. They're just a shiny trophy on the shelf, because attacking Syria or Lebanon with nukes means nuclear fallout on the Zionist colony itself, and it means also targeting of the Muna reactor, which is blowing it up is like blowing a nuke. So it's a mutual destruction. So there, you know, nukes we should not be worried about, and the liberation is coming soon.
Thank you for that. We're going to end it there. Laith Maruf from Beirut, activist and political commentator. Say Mohsen Abbas, a pleasure. Thank you for your input. Journalist and political commentator from London. And we had Mariam Saleh, correspondent at the top of the spotlight. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikavi Tahwei, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasim Ali Himani and Sheikh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome back there.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Let's get to today's topic, and that is an analysis on what the Islamic houses are doing all around the world. You know, of course, when you look at the world of Islam, these houses or the Islamic seminaries is better. This is a rough translation, but would not be, you know, a good translation for that. Schools, Islamic schools or seminaries all around the world are acting differently. For example, if you look at the Egypt and Al-Azhar one, you know, its function is something. But if you look at, for example, the Islamic House of Qom and Najaf, the function might be a little bit different. The both of them are doing research on Islam and different branches of the Islamic studies, but still there are some differences between the two. First of all, give us a picture of what's happening in the Islamic houses around the world. I don't know, in both Sunni one or the Shia ones, what are they mainly concerned with, brother?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. You know, basically what is done in the houses or in seminary schools, Islamic seminary schools, almost the same, but the difference are coming out normally from the, you know, the foundations of the, you know, or the sources that are taking their teachings from.
Mm-hmm.
So what is done in the houses is trying to sort of reaching the capability or this capacity of inferring the Islamic teachings from its sources.
Okay.
But so this is what is done in all the houses all around the world.
Mm-hmm. Whether but the methods are different.
Yeah, but the methods are different, or okay. The sources that are used.
Uh-huh.
So the Shias normally they are respecting the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam, mm-hmm. as they respected the prophetic traditions, and you know, but on the Sunni side, you see that, for example, the traditions of the Sahaba,
mm-hmm.
actually are respected, and the Sunnah of the Sahaba, okay. as they sometimes call it. It's not just, you know, the traditions or narrations that the Sahabas are narrating from the Holy Prophet. Even the traditions and the Sunnah and the conduct of the Sahaba, okay. themselves,
yes.
are actually regarded as the sources, okay. of religion as well for the Sunnis. So is it
about the new generations of the Islamic houses? Because, for example, in the city of Qom nowadays, we could see the houses which are mainly concerned with new sciences and new fields of studies too, as it was not, for example, in the past generation of the ulama, maraje, Muslim authorities in Najaf, Mashhad, and Qom. Is it so?
Actually, if you look at A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim, bismillahir rahmanir rahim. If you look at the Hausa system, the human life by itself, mm-hmm. you know, it has progressed tremendously compared to what it was 100 years ago, and the things that we're dealing with have changed dramatically, right?
Yes.
So earlier we were dealing with a very simple life. People used to go work, and then they would have some complications in risk halal and haram, and they would come back and do istifta, ask questions about that particular scenario. But now the human race has progressed so much into technology, into fiat money, into cryptocurrencies and all that, that now the field has widened up so much more, psychology, physiology. So now the number of questions and number of areas and fields that the Hausa needs to venture into, mm-hmm. has also widened up and
okay.
expanded. So
yes.
earlier, for example, you wouldn't find many scholars delving into the topic of child upbringing in an Islamic way, or
yes.
Islamic civilization, you know,
yes.
what are the fundamentals and the foundations of it, or the Islamic culture, how do we build an Islamic culture in a particular society and stuff like that. But now you see that, you know, the world is moving towards
yes.
these new ventures, new avenues and new concepts. And therefore, Islam cannot choose, or Hausa cannot choose to remain behind in these concepts. So very true that as we are progressing
yes.
as mankind into different ventures, Hausa has to, step into those areas and
yes.
then gain that necessary expertise in those areas as well. So that if someone has
yeah.
questions about it, we
yes.
have relative answers for that.
The very recent example was the transplant of the pig's heart to a human being.
Yeah.
So many questions were poured into the Dafatar of Maraja
yeah.
here and there on the Islamic world. Is it allowed or not? According to Sayyid al-Sistani, you know, it is jayez, okay? It is,
yeah,
is permitted,
to
no problem.
The,
so, you know, this is a new experiment on the science that, I don't know, would it be successful or not, but especially it is because it is pig, you know, and the pork
yeah,
is forbidden in Islam,
and,
it's haram.
Yeah.
So what about transplanting the heart of a pig to
is
a human being?
Is there a stihale or not?
Yes.
All those
yes.
questions, very
all
true.
Those questions come up, yeah.
yeah.
Actually, there's another source for,
okay.
you know, sort of renewing the approaches towards religion and how to
mm-hmm.
acquire religions, which is the misconceptions that are now raised against religion. So
okay.
as we were talking before this session, you know, there are some misconceptions and shubuhah that are raised by the atheists or, you know, by anti-religion movements that are actually coming from
mm-hmm.
some sciences that were not that much, you know, familiar. The Hausa students were not
yes.
that much familiar with them. So now they feel this need and
yes.
urge to go and study those sciences in order for first understanding those shubuhat and those misconceptions, and then try to answer it and defend.
There is still third generation who comes from straight and directly comes from the Islamic teachings of the Hausa, but then they become broad-minded, so-called intellectuals. You know, they are believing Muslims, but at the same time, the doubts that they are posing and this methods that they are introducing is very much different from the previous one. On, for example, the system of the Wahy, on the text of the Holy Quran, how it was revealed to Prophet Muhammad, the stories, the incidents around in Islamic history. I do want to say these are also the new generations of the students from the Hausa who have studied in the Hausa, okay? And we could see here and there the rebuttals that are heard. What are these questions for? What at all? This method was not. Is it a new thing? It is a bid'ah, it's an innovation you are doing. And this makes the problem more complex.
It does, to a certain extent. But then, if you look at the whole Islamic system, the Hausa system, there's always been this methodology that have been followed. Even in Usul and Fiqh, you would see that right from Sheikh Mufid and Sheikh Tusi and all that. They had their point of view, they had their opinion, and the scholars who followed them, including sometimes you would see the student of the teacher would come back and say, look, you have this point of view, but I do not agree with it. I have a difference of opinion with you in this particular point of view. Like, look at Sheikh Shahid Baqir al-Sadr.
Yes.
And when it comes to Usul, he has a totally different approach about jurisprudence compared to the earlier scholars, right? So I think Islam is a very open-minded kind of approach. Hausa is very open to this kind of thing where it says if you have a difference of opinion and you have evidence and you have proof and dalil to prove your point of view, then we are open for it. Come, present your point of view, let's discuss, and we have our own defense, we have our own answers, we have our own questions when you present your dalil, and if your dalil is good enough and you're able to prove your point, great, we'll accept it, right? But if you're not able to prove your point, then well, you'll have to retract and you'll have to agree that you've not done a good job in your research. So I don't think Hausa is very narrow-minded to say that, look, you have a point of view and we are totally against that.
Okay.
This new generation that you're talking about, these points are, again, ihtimalat. It's just point of view. So they have thought about it and they come up with an opinion.
Yes.
On the other hand, we have dalil and proofs which contradict those new point of views and, point out that these are quite baseless, right?
Okay.
So if this new generation talking about wahy and all that stuff, if they have strong dalil, then well, I think people are okay to accept it. But we clearly see that they lack all this strong dalil.
And do you believe is it at all right for the Hausa and the Hausa scholars in order to enter into scientific fields which are concerned with the matter or materialistic ground? They could say this is not my field, as in today's world, Everybody says, I'm an expert in only in this field of history or field of history. Is it all right for the Hausa scholars, ulama, and the scholars, clergymen, in order to get to those fields or not?
Actually, I believe that it's upon their shoulder to go.
Really?
Yeah, for sure. Why? There are two reasons. First of all, nowadays we see that there are some, reinforcement that we can actually take from these scientific fields that we have. I refer to one of them in one of our previous sessions, which is the fine-tuning argument that is coming from physics and, probability theory. So if you're not familiar with those topics, at least we have to have some people, talking about these. There are some people in the West, that are well-versed in, both religious studies and scientific and, natural sciences that are needed in those fields. So this is the first reason that we can make use of those fields in order for strengthening our beliefs.
Okay.
The second thing is to encounter misconceptions that are raised based on the teachings of those sciences. So if you want, we say we have this ilm al-kalam, and the person, the theologian, has this responsibility to first understand religion, the teachings, the religious teachings, and then defend the religion doctrine. So We have this responsibility as theologians. So if you're not familiar with that, with the root of that misconception, which is scientific information or sciences, you cannot, prepare a good answer, reply for those misconceptions.
And do you believe it is a role of the theologians? Those people in Kalam, and not Faqih, or the jurisprudent, the jurists of Islam?
I mean, an Islamic scholar, actually, according to the Quran, what we need as a scholar is a person who is Islamic scholar or religious scholar. Mm-hmm. We don't have this term of faqih, even though that is used.
Okay.
It is used in traditions, but by faqih, the Ahlul Bayt and the Quran, or the scholar, maybe what it meant by it is a person who has the knowledge of religion, not just a person who has limited understanding of some parts of religion, which is fiqh or jurisprudence.
Okay.
So this is what we have. So even if there from our religious scholars that are, simultaneously are faqih and at the same time a theologian and a philosopher.
This is the main doubt that was made about the past generation of the fuqaha, that, for example, an old alim beside a house in the far, far lands of Najaf or Qom or Mashhad cannot answer, for example, so many new doubts and questions about the new world. So this Jahanbini, this worldview, is lacked, for example, in the ideas of that, for example, old scholar, old man. And who is this man? This man is in charge of, for example, of an Islamic hausa. How could that hausa can answer the needs, the today's need of the people of human beings?
The ulama, the hausa system, and the scholars are warisul anbiya. Mm-hmm. So when you say they're warisul anbiya, does that mean that they're only warisul anbiya for religious knowledge, religious information? Were prophets only well-versed in religious content? Or no, they were well-versed in all aspects of life. And the Anbiya were the leaders of the community. They were leaders of the society. They were leaders for the mankind in all fields, all areas, be it child upbringing, be it science, be it technology, be it medicine, whatever. They were leaders in that. So when we say ulama are warisul Anbiya, it doesn't mean it's only in that marifat-e-ilahi or marifat-e-dini that we are expected to be leaders. We are supposed to be warisul anbiya, meaning lead all the different fields that are related to human beings. Mm-hmm. Take
and
example
the Quran
of
says liyatafaqahu fid-din. It doesn't say liyatafaqahu fil-fiqh faqat.
Correct. And deen is a way of life.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Qasim, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
on the news line.
The MKO terrorist group appears to be expanding its operations to include trafficking, among other criminal activities. An Albanian historian and journalist says the country's police have alerted the U.S. embassy that members of the terrorist organization are involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. Alsi Jazeshi, citing Albanian media reports, says the MKO operatives, headed by the terrorist ringleader Mariam Rajavi and based in a camp near the capital Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 of the group's own members to France. Jazeshi added that a number of the terrorist cult's members have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, who were most likely Daesh terrorists. The journalist also says some senior MKO members, including the ringleader's sister-in-law, have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs into Italy, with police having prosecuted another member over theft charges. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating further. The journalist says the terror group has forced an Albanian media outlet to take down an article it published about the arrests.
They used Albania as a safe haven to carry out illegal activities and criminal acts. And now they are becoming a problem for Greece, Italy, Germany, and France. And when I say problem, not just trafficking human beings, drugs, money laundering, and some other activities. They have become a problem for Albania for the crimes I just mentioned, but also burglary, pickpocketing, harassing women, sexual harassment, and at least one case of rape.
Critics in Albania blame the United States and its Western allies for providing protection for the terrorist cult. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 28, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Most recently, Iran said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in November 2020. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
Some of them have their hands stained with blood. Some of them have battlefield experience. Some of them have some formal training by Mukhabarat, the special secret police of Saddam Hussein. So they are not just two people trying to go to Europe to make a living. They are a danger. Criminals need to go to prison, not to roam in the streets of European cities. Absolutely. This is my idea.
Since removing their decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. But the latest revelations about the terror organization can serve as a wake-up call for its Western supporters that the threats they have been brewing against Iran will backfire on them.
The government of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in trouble. His cabinet has invoked a rarely used emergency ordinance to quell anti-vaccine truck protests that have crippled the country. The Emergency Act can authorize the use of the military. It can also temporarily suspend citizens' rights to free movement or assembly, and the government is taking steps to stop financial support of illegal protests. The measure allows Canadian banks to freeze accounts suspected of funding the blockades and suspend insurance on vehicles in the protests. Trudeau has noted that the measures will be time-limited, geographically targeted, as well as reasonable and proportionate. The Canadian law, which was passed in 1988, says, for the purpose of this act, a national emergency is an urgent and critical situation of a temporary nature that cannot be effectively dealt with under any other law of Canada. Trudeau said, the government is not overriding the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, nor limiting the right to peaceful assembly.
The federal government has invoked the Emergency Act to supplement provincial and territorial capacity to address the blockades and occupations.
The plan has drawn widespread condemnation from Canadians, including the Premier in Quebec, Francis Legault, who said Trudeau's announcements risk putting oil on the fire. The trouble all began after thousands of protesters in trucks and other vehicles blocked the streets of Ottawa, as well as two border crossings with the U.S. to vent their frustration over COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The protests have not stayed in Canada, though. Similar freedom convoy protests have grown in countries like the U.S., France, New Zealand, Australia. As common with protests, many have also vented their anger against the government due to their economic situation as a result of COVID-19.
Spontaneous thing where people are upset. That's one whole part of this, and it's part of a general movement, I think, that we're seeing around the world of the ultra-right asserting itself and using the money of the millionaires to do it.
The so-called Freedom Convoy protests started with truckers protesting COVID-19 vaccine or quarantine mandate. It then broadened to include people opposing all coronavirus-related restrictions announced by the Trudeau government. The protest has attracted the support of thousands of Canadians, even some who are fully vaccinated. They say all COVID-19 preventive measures must be dropped. The protests have drawn support from groups from the U.S.
Having is a right-wing attack on all kinds of things, because one of the demands of the people in Canada was that Trudeau should resign, and the other was that the western part of the country should secede. So, you know, these are not just little political things. So you have, in Canada in particular, the implementation of a very conservative right-wing agenda. And everybody agrees on that, especially the right-wing who's doing it. So this isn't just some kind of, you know, spontaneous thing where people are upset.
Canadian authorities have said about half of the funding for the protests has come from U.S. supporters. Toronto Dominion Bank last week froze two personal bank accounts that received $1.4 million for the protests. In the western Canadian province of Alberta, police have broke up a group that was armed and prepared to use violence. The protests that have hindered traffic at border crossings have impacted more than $500 million in commerce each day.
I think that what happened was that the automobile companies complained. You know, there's production shut down, millions of dollars lost. And it was pretty clear that that was very unpopular. And he waited long enough for the economy to be heard and people to be heard and said, enough's enough. And I think the balance of force has changed a bit because of that.
Truckers and their supporters have gathered in the capital, Ottawa, since January 29th to rally against mask mandates, lockdowns, restrictions on gatherings, and other COVID-19 preventive measures. Some downtown Ottawa businesses have had to shut down temporarily. There have been reports of rock throwing, property damage, harassment, and even hate crimes.
Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood made headlines once again on Sunday. Clashes broke out between Israeli forces and Palestinian residents in the area after far-right Jewish lawmaker Itamar Ben-Gvir opened a parliamentary office in Sheikh Jarrah. Tens of Palestinians were injured in the Israeli crackdown. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates condemned Ben-Gvir's step as a provocative and escalating move that threatens to ignite violence. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the Israeli regime is fully and directly responsible for the escalation in the occupied Al-Quds and potentially dire consequences of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It added that the failure of the international community and the United Nations Security Council to take necessary measures to compel Israel to stop its occupation of Al-Quds encourages the occupying power to forge ahead with its colonial Judaization projects in the Holy City.
Well, that was expected, and he did it largely as a publicity stunt and to raise his profile within Zionist politics in Israel, and of course to shove it in the face of the Palestinian Christian and Arab or Muslim community that lives in the area. But it was designed for controversy. But it definitely is a political stunt, and it's designed to increase tensions in the area. And this is most unfortunate and illegal, and mostly condemned around the world as an attempt to Judaize the area and to drive out the Palestinians.
Earlier, the Hamas resistance movement had issued a strongly worded message of warning to the Israeli regime and settlers after the latter renewed their attacks on Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Mohammed Hamadeh, a spokesman for the Gaza-based movement, said the attack amounts to a clear violation and that Israel was playing with fire. Israel's attempts to evict families from the Flashpoint Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood resulted in an 11-day war between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups and Israel back in May. Israel is evicting Palestinians to make way for its settlement-building activities. This is while under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Al-Quds remains at the heart of the decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East Al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers believe any escalation of violence or provocative action by Israeli forces in the Holy City could serve as a prelude to a new intifada.
It is part of the Judaization of East Jerusalem, and it's an attempt by Zionists to drive the Christian and Muslim Arabs out of the city and increase the Jewish population.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's unqualified support, Tel Aviv expanded its illegal activities against the people of Palestine. Many were expecting a turn of events when Trump left office, but the regime continues to carry out its acts of aggression in the absence of any meaningful action from the international community.
Bahrain has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising backed by majority Shias demanding greater civil and political rights from the Saudi-backed monarchy. Since mid-February 2011, thousands of anti-regime protesters have held numerous demonstrations on the streets of Bahrain, calling for the family to relinquish power. Scores of Bahrainis have been killed and hundreds of others injured and arrested in an ongoing crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. Following the repression of the pro-democracy movement in February of 2011, the government of Bahrain established the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, or BICI, in July the same year. In November 2011, the BICI Commission handed over their finalized report to King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. The report outlined 26 recommendations for the government of Bahrain. They addressed a number of systematic government abuses. Several recommendations addressed the lack of accountability of government authorities accused of ill treatment and torture. The BICI Commission put forth suggestions to address Bahraini court's dismissal of judicial due process procedures and arbitrary detention of peaceful political activities. The Commission sought to address the sectarianized public security force that lacked training in the human rights dimensions of detention and interrogation. Some recommendations also sought to reinstate Bahraini workers and students after their dismissal from businesses and schools for their participation in the pro-democracy protests. However, 11 years after the beginning of Bahrain's popular uprising, the Al Khalifa regime has yet refrained from fully implementing the 26 recommendations and continues its crackdown on any form of dissent. The regime even dissolved its main opposition group, the Al Wefaq National Islamic Society, and liquidated the group's funds back in 2016. Al-Wefaq has time and again urged international rights groups to visit the notorious Bahraini prisons and inspect the conditions of detention for the political detainees in the kingdom. Also previously, the European Center for Democracy and Human Rights had voiced concern over the deplorable condition of imprisoned Bahraini pro-democracy campaigners, warning that political dissidents and opposition figures are slowly dying in the Manama regime's jails and detention centers. The organization called for urgent action in solidarity with jailed Bahraini opposition leader and the Secretary General of the Haq movement, Hassan Mushaima, as well as imprisoned human rights activist Abdeljalil Abdullah Al-Singas, as the pair suffer from multiple health problems but are being denied proper health care. Also, political detainee Hossein Barakat died in captivity of Al-Khalifa regime from COVID-19 after being barred from proper medical treatment. Prominent human rights activist Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in regime prisons, as well as Nabil Rajab, who has been behind bars for criticizing the Al-Khalifa regime's involvement in the Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, are two other detainees who have played a prominent role in the Bahraini revolution. Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in the country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there can't be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. Sheikh Qasim had previously urged the regime in Manama to pursue an agreement with the Bahraini opposition instead of increasingly suppressing dissent. Meanwhile, Bahraini opposition groups have called for mass participation in rallies marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising, as the Al-Khalifa regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on dissent in the Persian Gulf country. The opposition groups also stressed their faithful adherence to the principles and goals of the 2011 popular uprising stipulated in the Pearl Charter, the foremost of which are putting an end to the dictatorial tribal rule in Bahrain, establishing the right to self-determination and exposing its falsified nature before the international community. Pro-democracy protests have continued to be held in Bahrain on a regular basis ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011, but the regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. The participants demand that the Al-Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, creating habit in children. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of creating a habit in the children in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the Islamic lifestyle, especially when we look at our general life, we see that our children have different habits. But according to Islamic teachings, it is necessary to make some habits in the children, to build some habits, and to make them perform something or some activities which are religious and which will help them in having a pure Islamic lifestyle. If we are living especially in the West, where we have the Western culture, when we go out, everyone is opposing what we believe In such circumstance, it is necessary, and even in the Islamic countries, it is necessary that from the childhood, we need to train our kids, we need to train our children in order to raise them with the Islamic lifestyle or in the Islamic lifestyle. Therefore, one of the habits which we should create in our daughters especially, that is to have veil or to observe hijab when they go outside, or when someone like uncle who is non-mahram, obviously when we talk about the non-mahram, it's the father's cousins, and obviously the people or the father's friends, or similarly for the boys, it's the mother's friends and the other relatives, even when they're the cousins next to each other. So we're talking about them, not the real uncle, like the brother of the father. So because he's mahram. So when the non-mahram, the one who is in front of whom the girl should have hijab or observe hijab when they come in the house, even if the little girl is or your daughter is maybe 3 years old or 4 years old, you should try to teach them and make this habit that whenever they are there, they should observe hijab. Even when you buy a doll for your daughter, try to buy dolls which have good clothes, which are covered properly. Or maybe, you know, we have this thing like Islamic dolls. So you can use them so that this girl, this little girl, this daughter who is raising up in your house can see how to live in the society, and she should learn all these things, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the habits that we need to build in our children. And we said for the daughters, it is good to teach them how to observe hijab when they're 3 years old. And if you buy scarves for them, whenever you go out, they're observing hijab, they will learn that when they turn 9 years old, how to observe hijab. If it is hard for you to do that at the age of three, then you can try at age of four or five, but not later, because the age of five for girls, obviously their intellectual level is higher than the boys, and they do understand things better than the boys. So therefore, there is a difference of creation between the woman and the man. So therefore, if we can observe this, if we can make this habit or build this habit in our daughters, they will learn how to protect themselves, how to keep their hijab, and how to observe the Islamic lifestyle. On the other side, we need to also teach our sons that when there is a non-mahram, what to do, how to lower their eyes when they are in front of the strangers. Strangers means like non-mahram, like those who they should not see, they should not look upon them. And even if there is a mixed gathering, how to deal, how to live, how to socialize with the people in such gatherings, what to do. All these things should be done when they are like in the earlier age, and when they are accepting what you say. So the time when they can absorb all these things, that is the time to train them. Not the time when they are grown up, they become teenage, and they become baligh, and then you are trying to, or we are trying to force them to observe the Islamic teachings, to follow the Islamic teachings. Therefore, it is necessary to train the kids by making some habits in them so that they can practice it, and it becomes the part of their life, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In October, White House officials reportedly disregarded a proposal from testing experts to send rapid tests directly to Americans in anticipation of a COVID-19 spike during the holidays, says Bianca Fortis, reporter, in an article published under the heading, Biden's Pandemic Testing Board has done little to nothing since its creation. Stay tuned for more. When President Joe Biden was campaigning for office, he said that to beat the coronavirus, the U.S. needed a testing equivalent of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's War Production Board. That board had sweeping powers to shift the country's economy to support a war effort, and it ultimately oversaw a reported 40% of the world's munition production during the Second World War. The day after his inauguration, Biden signed an executive order creating the Pandemic Testing Board. He said he would be putting the full force of the federal government behind expanding testing. A year later, though, it's remarkably hard to tell what the board has done. As far as experts can find, the group has put out no press releases, held no hearings, and made no announcements. Biden's executive order states that the head of the board would be or be chosen by the White House's head of COVID-19 response. That's Jeffrey Zients, but when reporters contacted him, he didn't respond. When reporters asked White House officials about the pandemic testing board, who was on it and what actions it had taken, they declined to answer questions and pointed reporters to the Department of Health and Human Services. That agency did respond to inquiries about the board, but its answers offered few details about the board's work. It did not say who is on the panel or what decisions it has made. The agency said the Pandemic Testing Board serves as the forum where agencies across the federal government, which are involved in testing, can describe emerging challenges and what they are learning. It provides a mechanism of addressing policy and implementation issues regarding the supply and distribution of tests, as well as increasing access to and affordability of tests in the community. The agency's full statement also notes that the board has met regularly and has been split into two groups, one focused on test supply and the other on testing policies. Public health experts told reporters they too hadn't heard much about the board. Jennifer Nutso, an epidemiologist and professor at Johns Hopkins University, said, "I had assumed that they jettisoned these plans. If it still exists, it is certainly very low profile," said Lawrence Gosting, a professor of global health law at Georgetown University. The country's first coronavirus testing czar, Adam Brett Guerrier, said he knew little about it as well. "It is rumored to have met, but I did not see public disclosure or reports from the meetings. Of course, the inner workings of a board are less important than whether the government is getting the job done. But as ProPublica detailed in November, the Biden administration has been slow to roll out wider testing, just what the board was created to do. In October, White House officials reportedly disregarded a proposal from testing experts to send rapid tests directly to Americans in anticipation of a COVID-19 spike during the holidays. Press Secretary Jen Psaki also infamously dismissed the idea in a December briefing. Later that month, the Biden administration announced it would send tests directly to Americans. But the tests are arriving just as the Omicron wave is receding, and critics have argued that the effort shortchanges communities of color. David Paltiel, professor of public health at Yale University, said, "I think it's damn well about time. It's never too late, but some of us have been screaming and yelling about the idea for more than 18 months. There was no shortage of money for expanding testing. As part of last year's stimulus package, Congress appropriated nearly $48 billion for testing, contact tracing, and other efforts to prevent the spread of COVID-19. That is in addition to $48 billion set aside for testing in 2020. But just like with the board's activities, details about where exactly the money has gone have been hard to come by. Senators Richard Beer and Roy Blunt sent a letter on January 3rd asking for similar information. After Beer's office shared what it had learned, the Biden administration sent ProPublica a one-page rundown of COVID-19 spending recently. The allocations thus far include $10 billion for testing in schools, $9 billion for manufacturing testing supplies, nearly $5 billion for testing uninsured individuals, and more than $4 billion for testing and mitigation measures for high-risk populations. Nearly $3.9 billion went toward free community testing at pharmacies and federally qualified health centers, and $2.9 billion went to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for expanding labs and testing capacity. More than $1.9 billion has gone toward COVID-19 testing of unaccompanied minors at the U.S.-Mexico border.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
Knowledge and piety are the criteria of evaluation in monotheist doctrines. The question of manifestation of deeds and manifestation of morality and so forth is a subject that is recognized among the experts and researchers. It has also been mentioned that the tongue of a person which is slander lengthens to the distance between Mecca and Medina apparently, and on the day of resurrection walk across this tongue. This is the result of a slandering. A person whose tongue stretches from this city to that city, and he defames people and reveals their secrets, this tongue extends to the same extent that it would stretch in this world, in the afterworld also. hereafter also, and on the resurrection day, according to this narrative, people will walk across it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islamic Revolution. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini said that, "I hope Khomeini shall never deviate from the straight path of Islam, which is resistance against the oppressive powers, and never relent in his efforts to achieve the objectives of Islam." Now, in this part of his speech, he is talking to himself. He is addressing himself in front of public that, "I pray to God that I never deviate from the straight path." And this is one of the most important supplications that we always must do to God, to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala take us or keep us on the right path. And we should never be deviated from the right path. And therefore, we have this in the month of Ramadan. We read this supplication a lot, like, "Oh, Rabbana, La tuzigh qulubana ba'da idh hadaytana." O God, when you have guided us, do not let us be deviated from the right path, because you have shown us the right path. So this is what Imam Khomeini is also saying.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi.
In search of Islam, you should always strive for Islam. You should always be with the Islam so that you are not deviated from Islam. And you should always pray that God should not make you deviate from the straight path of Islam, because everything is Islam. We have our lives because of Islam. We have our existence because of Islam. That's what he says, that this Islam is resistance against the oppressive powers, and it brings justice in our life. So we need to be against these oppressive powers. And he also says that, "I also pray that I never relent in his efforts, in the efforts of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to achieve the objectives of Islam." Therefore, we must always strive for Islam. We should never be relent in order to achieve the objectives of Islam. Therefore, Islam is the main cause, is the main goal which we need to achieve. And that's what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent for us through his prophets, so that we can reach to the perfection, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.